Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today's one and only guest, Frank Bardeke, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, just published by Verso. Before that, some words on the news. They're still trying to scare us about the fiscal cliff. Now we learn that Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, who have nothing interesting to say on the topic, are nonetheless getting paid $40,000 each to tell business audiences what they want to hear. The only way to avoid financial ruin is to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Amazing how much you can make if you've already got a lot and flatter the prejudices of those richer than you. No news there. But here's one interesting bit of news. When I first got into the lucrative field of radical economic journalism in the mid-1980s, the Latin American debt crisis was one of the big stories of the time. That was all solved, can you hear the air quotes, during the late 1980s and 1990s in ways very pleasing to the creditors at the expense of a decade of depression in the Southern Hemisphere. The story fell off the front pages once the risk to the banks disappeared. But early in this new millennium, Argentina tired of the neoliberal regime and defaulted on its debts. The strategy worked out quite well, as the country clocked an average annual growth rate in GDP per capita of over 6% since 2002, almost six times Mexico's and over eight times ours. Almost all holders of the defaulted-on bonds agreed to accept new ones on far less favorable terms than the originals, but there were some holdouts, notably some vulture funds that refused the deal and sued instead. Last week, Thomas Grisa, a federal judge based in New York, ruled that Argentina couldn't pay any interest in the new bonds until it paid off the vultures first. Argentina doesn't want to do that, but Judge Grisa ordered the banks would have to transfer the funds not to violate his ruling. This sets up a fascinating fight. Instead of the old 19th century approach, sending in gunboats to collect, Grisa is now using the international payment system to isolate a debtor country. Holders of the new bonds aren't happy. The decision would benefit only a small group of vultures who could make big money if they get their way. Will Greece's decision be overruled? Will Argentina find a way around it? Or will it default on everything all over again? Behind the News, we'll be following this one closely. Let's take a musical break. Some of the first movement of Schubert's Trout Quintet, performed by Rudolf Serkin, Jaime Laredo, Philip Negele, Leslie Parnas, and Julius Levine, from the Marlboro Festival in 1967. Bit of a cliché, but a beautiful one. My only guest today is Frank Bardeke, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, just published by Verso. Frank, who lives in Watsonville, California, in the midst of some prime agricultural territory, is no parachute journalist. He worked in the fields himself for six seasons and spent 15 years reading, interviewing, and writing to make this book. Although Chavez is well known in California, I suspect that non-Californians under the age of 50, those unlike me for whom the great boycott of the late 1960s and early 1970s isn't a vivid memory, those may not be all that familiar with him and the union he led, the United Farm Workers. Founded in 1965, the UFW had a remarkable rise to prominence and power over the next decade, and then an equally remarkable decline. The rise, as Frank will tell us, was a result of some extremely brilliant strategies on the part of Chavez and his colleagues, though Chavez was indisputably the major figure in the union by a long shot. And the decline was the product both of the enormous power of employers, backed by the state, and of some serious problems internal to the union, including an undemocratic cult of personality around the almost sanctified figure of Chavez. Frank Bardeke. Welcome, Frank. Before we get to the Chavez story, there were several ways of organizing in the 20th century in the fields of California in the teens and the 30s. Tell us some about those before we get to the Chavez story.
Well, there's basically two important groups that organized in the fields. First was the Wobblies, and the next was the Communists. And what characterized the Wobblies was the fact that there were very, very few outside organizers among the Wobblies. The Wobblies were mostly farm workers, the people who did the work, and they carried a Wobbly card in their pocket. And they tried to get different nationalities together, because that was one of the problems in the fields of the times, that there were so many different nationalities and couldn't even talk to each other. And people, one nationality was used against another nationality to break their strikes. And so a big part of their effort was to get the different nationalities together and to focus their enmity against the boss rather than against each other. They also were kind of a self-help group. They tried to get people to stop drinking so much, and they tried to organize. They organized the camps, the hobo camps, and they tried to build a culture. The Wobblies really tried to build a culture of cooperation among farm workers. They were quite successful. The Wobblies were quite successful in the California fields. Part of the reason that they were charged with criminal syndicalism and thrown in jail after the First World War in the California extension of the Palmer Raids was because they had been so successful in the California fields. They raised wages. They had a lot of successful strikes. And the key to their success was the vulnerability of the growers during the harvest. Because growers are very vulnerable during a harvest. Farm workers have a lot of power at harvest time because the harvest is intermittent. You know, the growers have to put all this money into producing a product, and then the product is harvested only for a very short period of time. And so if you lose the harvest because of bad weather or because of strike or because of a slowdown, you lose all the money that you invested before, and there's no way to make it up after the strike is over or after the bad weather passes because the harvest is gone. So growers are very vulnerable during harvest time, and the Wobblies make good use of that vulnerability and were actually quite successful.
And then they were their success was undone by the state, right?
Yeah. I mean, there were like hundreds of Wobblies were arrested at the end of the First World War, and many were sent to San Quentin. They were charged with criminal syndicalism, put on trial, and thrown in jail, and their organization was pretty much wrecked.
And then the Communists in the 30s, what was their contribution?
Communists in the 30s is a slightly different story. If people are really interested in it, there's an excellent book by Deborah Weber called Dark Skin and White Gold, I think, or something like that. I think that's the name of it. Anyway, yeah, the Communists it was during, you know, what's called the Third Period, where the Communists were organizing separate independent unions, and that may not have made sense in the industrial heartland, but it did make sense in the California fields, because the AFL and the CIO weren't doing any organizing in the fields. And the AFL had a position against organizing Mexicans into any kind of unions. So there was an open field there, and the Communists put a lot of energy into it in California, and they worked very closely with groups of Mexican leftists who had crossed the border to come to work in the fields. So the revolutionary rhetoric didn't really scare off these Mexican leftists, who were quite used to it. And in 1933, there was a huge strike wave in the fields, and it was at one point one third of all California farm workers were on strike, which was, you know, a higher percentage than the people who were in strike in industries. And they set up wages. They sent up wages very high. They won the strikes in terms of raising wages, but they weren't strong enough to build lasting unions. Because the same way that I said farm workers have power during harvest time, farm worker power melts away after the harvest is over. So there's this kind of tradition of militancy within the farm worker culture, but there was an inability to build a lasting union. And then the communists also were attacked quite virulently by the Associated Farmers and also by the state. And many, there were like 22 of them were put on trial for criminal syndicalism for their actions during the 1933 cotton strike. And about, I forget, I think 12 of them went to San Quentin for a number of years. And when they got out of jail, the third period had passed and the Popular Front was with us, and there was no return to the fields.
Just as a general issue, what do farm workers do in the off-season when they're not harvesting? Is it a migrant population?
Yeah, well, it's less migrant than it used to be. It's less migrant than it used to be. There is some, there's still some migrancy, but there's also some farm workers. If you have your papers, you can get unemployment insurance during the off-season, which was a victory of the UFW, the struggle during the 1970s. And there tends to be more settled farm worker communities in rural California where people do what they can to get by. Now, there used to be, up till about, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, a lot of farm workers who would go back to Mexico, still, in the off-season. But since a large number of farm workers don't have papers, it's really, you can go back to Mexico, but once you get in Mexico, it's very hard these days to come back to the United States. It's either very hard or very expensive. The last I heard, I think it costs about $3,000 to cross at a crossing point and about $2,000 to cross in the desert. So that's a lot of money for a farm worker. And farm workers tend to go in groups and if you're, if a number of people want to go back to Mexico for the winter, it's quite expensive to come back, and so they don't do it. So it raises a level of poverty in these small California towns.
Okay, so now let's skip forward some. What was going on with any kind? Was there any kind of organizing after the 30s until the UFW got going in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah. There was Ernesto Galarza was something called the National Farm Worker Labor Union, which organized a strike at the DiGiorgio, a very, very big grape grower, and actually tried to build a boycott out of it, but it was unsuccessful. The thing that was difficult about striking in that period was the Bracero program. The Bracero program starts at the beginning of the... It starts at the beginning of the Second World War and goes to 1964. I mean, that's like, you know, 24 years. And this is a program of contracted Mexican workers, single men, who come into the state and can work for only the companies that contract them. And they stay in labor camps away from the towns, and then they're bused into the fields. They harvest the crops. And then they're bused back to their camps where they eat and live. And then when the harvest is over, they're taken back to Mexico. And it was actually a kind of apartheid system, a semi-apartheid system, because the little towns, these little agricultural towns, like the town that I live in, Watsonville, remained a kind of white town, even though the labor that made the town wealthy was done by all these Mexican workers who were prohibited from participating in the life of the town. They didn't bring their families with them. Their children didn't go to the schools. They didn't use the parks. So it was kind of a nifty situation for the growers, and it kept farm worker wages artificially low. Farm worker wages, it's kind of funny. Everybody thinks of farm workers as low wage workers, but in fact, before in California, before the Bracero program, farm worker wages were about 90% of industrial wages. And in some places where you worked for piece work, you could make quite a bit more than you could make as an average a factory wage. It was the Bracero program that brought wages artificially low. So in 1940, when the Bracero program begins, wages are 95 cents an hour. And in 1964, when the Bracero program ends, wages are $1.25 an hour. Well, that's a fall in wages if you include inflation. And those are precisely the years, you know, after the Second World War when the wages of the rest of the working class went up. So that when wages fell, so that when the UFW begins in 1965, at the end of the Bracero program, farm worker wages in California are about 40% of the industrial wage. One way to think of the UFW is that it was a correction on the artificial lowering of wages during the Bracero program, so that what happened when the Bracero program ends and it becomes much easier to organize, wages shoot up back to, at some periods, above the average industrial wage.
And before proceeding, it's important, you make this point very well, that people might think of agricultural labor as pretty simple stuff, but it actually requires lots of skill as well as back-breaking dedication.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Farm work is skilled labor. I worked in the fields for six seasons. It took me six seasons to become an average worker. People think of it as unskilled labor who've never done it. And one way to understand the skilled nature of it is that it hasn't been mechanized. Fresh fruit and vegetables, where the UFW organized, we're not talking about grains, has not been mechanized. People still work with tools in their hands, and they control the pace of their work. And the tools there's quite a few tricks to using those tools, and to be able to use them quickly enough and skillfully enough to keep up with a crew on a piecework crew to make a sufficient enough of money to live is quite a feat. Also, there's another thing. You know, people know that it's hard work and that you have to work hard all day long, and people think that people who've never done it think that, well, that's just a question of determination or how badly you need the job. But in fact, I think it's more than that. The people who work in the fields, most of them grew up in small towns in Mexico and in farming towns, and they've been working in the fields since they were children. And they know how to work hard all day long, which in itself is a skill. And it is not just a question of how determined you are or how badly you need to do it. So that is a skill that's within farm worker culture and very hard to duplicate.
But also knowing what to pick and how takes a lot of study and practice.
If we were on TV, I could give you a demonstration. But the reason that farm labor hasn't been mechanized is because nature matures unevenly, so that when you go through a iceberg lettuce field, you don't cut all the lettuce that's there. Or when you pick fresh tomatoes, you don't pick all the tomatoes that are there. Or when you cut asparagus, you don't cut all the asparagus there. You have to cut the ones that are ready and leave the other ones for the next pass through. Well, there's quite a bit of skill involved in knowing just from the sight of a head of lettuce which lettuce is ready to cut and which is not ready to cut. You know, when the UFW was going strong and wages in the lettuce fields were approaching $20 an hour, the growers in the University of California spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to try to develop a lettuce cutting machine. And they had this big problem of not knowing, teaching the machine which lettuce was ready to cut and which should be left behind for the next pass through. And the best that they could come up with was a little X-ray machine that they X-rayed every piece of lettuce to see if it was hard enough for its mechanical knife to cut. But they assured us there would be no problem with that, no environmental problem or health problem. But in fact, they discarded the machine. They never really came up with a machine that could choose as efficiently as a human eye head of lettuce to cut. And this is true throughout fruits and vegetables. There have been a few fruits where, like, you know, they try to genetically engineer the stuff to make it so it matures all at the same time. They haven't yet been able to do that. They did it with canning tomatoes very famously, but where they just pick all the damn tomatoes green and don't worry about it.
I'm speaking with Frank Bardicke, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, just out from Verso. Okay, now we prepare the ground for Cesar Chavez. What formed him?
Prepare the ground, so to speak?
Yes. What formed him?
Well, It's an interesting story. It's all super interesting as far as I'm concerned. But that's a really good question. Caesar was not, well, to begin with, you have to remember that the people who founded the United Farm Workers Union, not only Cesar Chavez, but Dolores Huerta, Gil Padilla, and Helen Chavez, are all Mexican-Americans, or as they came to be called, Chicanos. Cesar's grandfather voted in a Texas election. He also homesteaded a farm in Arizona when it was still a territory before it was a state. And the outlook and sensibility of Mexican Americans there are some significant differences with the sensibility of migrants who come from Mexico. So Cesar grew up on a homesteaded farm in Arizona. And it was, according to his memory and his recollection, it was quite an idyllic childhood. And his father was a master horseman, and he played in the fields. He played outside. His dad was prosperous enough in the 20s to own a little store, and there was a pool table in it. Cesar became an excellent pool player. And then when Cesar was 10 years old in 1937, the dad, who had had several hard years because of the Depression, his father lost the farm to an Anglo lawyer who had paid the taxes that the dad couldn't pay on the farmland. And so at the age of 10, Cesar was thrust into the California Migrant Trail. A very, very rude awakening from a ranch home with a pool table in it and a little store connected to it. The home is basically the car that they're traveling in. It was the key thing. He remembers the fields as the sort of the end of his childhood. It's just a disaster for him, an absolute disaster. And he carried that view of the fields throughout his life. People in his family got out of the fields. When he went into the Second World War, when he went in the Navy in the Second World War, when he came back, he made one little attempt to go back to the fields, but he left immediately, and he became he was working in a lumber yard when he first got involved in politics. Wasn't in the fields anymore. So the fields for Cesar and for Mexican Americans in general are places that you want to get out of. It's kind of a disaster. But for Mexican immigrants to California, the fields can be a place of success. The wages, even if the wages are low, they're 10 times higher than your wages in Mexico. And the people who came and who made up the rank and file of the UFW were these Mexican immigrants. And for them, the fields were not a place they wanted to get out of. The fields were a success story. Some of them were making in the mid-70s, $20-$25 an hour. They had a lot of control over their work. They were successful people in their communities. Many of them built small businesses back in Mexico, and many of them settled here in the United States. Their kids went to college. They bought homes. The fields were not the same kind of problem that it had been for Cesar Chavez, and that because the union itself was run by Mexican Americans, not just people at the top, but the almost all of the administration of the union was Mexican American, and the rank and file of the union was Mexican. This was an added difference between the rank and file and the union bureaucracy. There's always problems between the rank and file and the union bureaucracy. Well, this was an added one.
And his mother's Catholicism was a very important influence on him, right?
Very important. Cesar was a serious Catholic. That wasn't just for political show. He was a serious Catholic. He was a believer. And he went to Mass regularly. And he believed in the Catholic Church. And that was useful to him, but it was also deeply, deeply felt.
And then his political influence among them was Saul Alinsky and his tradition. Talk to us about Alinsky's philosophy and what it did to Cesar Chavez.
Well, you can think of, in terms of Cesar's political background, sort of the ideas that he had in his head when he was organizing the UFW. It's a combination of Catholic social action and Alinskyism. And Alinsky, he was first, his first political activity were with Catholic priests. And he would go to the Bracero camps and help the Braceros in the company of these Catholic, of these left-wing or liberal Catholic priests. And when Fred Ross came to San Jose looking to build a Mexican-American organization that would organize people to vote, he went to the Catholic priests, as was his wont, and asked them if they knew anybody that they thought he should talk to. And the person that they recommended, one of the people they recommended, was Cesar. And for the next 10 years, Cesar's supervisor, direct supervisor, was Fred Ross. And Fred Ross is an early Alinskyite. There's some differences that he has with Alinsky that are sort of important within the Alinskyite point of view. But basically, he's a very early Alinskyite. And the organization that Cesar and Fred worked in, the CSO, the Community Service Organization, was funded by Alinsky. And Chavez had occasion many times to be in workshops with Alinsky and filed work reports that were read by Alinsky, and Alinsky made comments on them. And so this was his, it was a very big influence on him. Now, Alinskyism is a very hard thing to summarize in just a few words. Actually, almost everything is hard to summarize in just a few words, but Alinskyism particularly so. What I think was very important in terms of what Chavez, in terms of the trajectory of the UFW, is that Alinskyism puts its emphasis on the organizers. The organizers are the heroes of politics. Basically, what you see in Alinsky is that an organizer goes into a community which is unorganized, which is weak and ineffective, where people are competing with each other, and he, because of his particular political knowledge and his savvy, he can put that community together and make it a fighting force. And but the rank and file in this notion, the community itself, is not responsible for that, for that achievement. It's the organizer who is responsible for it. And the rank and there's ways that the rank and file are really kind of not important. Without the organizer, nothing would ever happen. And so what happens in the UFW is that there is this celebration of the organizer, and the organizers are, in fact, the officials of the union. They're the union bureaucracy. That's where the organizers are. And that the power of the union remained with the bureaucracy and was never put into the rank and file. This is actually quite dramatic in the UFW, because the UFW had no locals. There was no locals. Instead of locals, there were field offices, and the people in the field offices were appointed by the bureaucracy. There was nobody in the UFW until 1981, and that's a very special case, who was in the UFW officialdom who was elected by the rank and file. There was nobody who owed their job to the people below them rather than to people above them. Structurally, it was one of the least democratic unions in the United States. And I think Alinskyism, I think the hand of Alinsky is there, is present in that framework. There was lots of times that the UFW was a very democratic organization, but that's because times of mass struggle. And in times of mass struggle, when people are on strike and people come forward, then they just push past. They can just push past the union officialdom, and so you conceive of it as a democratic organization. But you know, the truth of the matter is that structurally, the UFW was less democratic than the Teamsters.
We're listening to Frank Bardicky, author of "Trampling Out the Vintage: Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls, the United Farm Workers," just published by Verso. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and in the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break. I'm gotten for the north. That was some of Garten, German for garden, by Gudrun Gut, from her newish album, Wildlife. And now back to Frank Bardicke, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls, The United Farm Workers, just published by Verso. It's interesting that both Catholic social doctrine and Alinskyism are both anti-communist, and Chavez himself was pretty anti-communist. How does that figure into the politics of the UFW?
Yeah, well, that's very much so. Cesar was authentically anti-communist. It was part of his political education. And Cesar later believes, I think it becomes important in the sort of when the UFW declines, he believes that people inside the union are a communist cabal, and that he believes that of fellow officials in the union, and he also believes it of the rank and file, that communists are organizing the rank and file against him. It was pretty much a fantasy. There were all kinds of leftists inside the, you know, because people could volunteer and go join the union. There were all kinds of leftists inside the union bureaucracy, but there was no organizing against Chavez or against the center. And in the field, there were definitely leftist farm workers. There were farm workers, the vast majority of the active farm workers in the Salinas Valley came from Michoacan and Jalisco, and they were Cardenistas. Their parents had been Cardenistas, and so there's a sort of a left tradition. And so there were lots of leftists in the fields, but nobody was organizing them against the UFW. There's a way that what happened in the UFW in the 1980s, late 70s and 80s, was a replication of what happened in the CIO in the early 1940s. Where communists were seen everywhere and kicked out of the union, much to the union's harm.
And so the union was founded in 1965, and it had a decade or more of substantial achievements. So just start us off. How'd they get going?
Well, it's the end of the Bracero program, and when the Bracero program ends, there's now a new opportunity to organize. And there had also been a mini strike wave before the end of the Bracero program. The Braceros had, in some cases, joined. And so there's a movement. And in the grapes, about 30% of the table grape workers in the Central Valley were Filipinos, especially in the San Joaquin in the lower part of the Central Valley. And there was an AFL-CIO affiliate that was organizing among Filipinos, and they went out on strike in 65. And Cesar, who had been, along with Gil Padilla and Helen and Dolores, had been organizing something they called the National Farm Workers Association among Mexicans, faced a decision of whether or not they were going to support the Filipino strike. And it was actually quite a moment, because Chavez figured that the strike was going to lose because there hadn't been enough work done beforehand in preparation, and people weren't ready to for an extended struggle. And but on the other hand, he knew that if the NFWA stayed out of the strike, if the Mexicans stayed out of the strike and didn't support the Filipinos, that it would be impossible for the foreseeable future to build the kind of unity that was necessary between the Filipinos and the Mexicans to win any future strikes. So he and the rest of the executive board decided to support the strike, even though they suspected the strike would not win. Now, this is a really crucial moment in the history of the UFW, because one of the reasons that Chavez made that decision, or the executive board made that decision, and Chavez was the main energy behind it, was that Cesar argued openly, look at the support that he would have said at the time, Negroes in the South are getting from Northern liberals, and look at how that has strengthened their hand. It's 1965. He said, if we can, even though we're probably going to lose this strike, if we can extend it in some way and keep it going and somehow figure out how to mobilize Northerners our allies in the cities, our potential allies in the cities in support of us, maybe we can win it. This was an incredibly prescient, smart observation. I mean, in retrospect, it looks easy, but at the time, it was very smart. And so the strike happened, and in fact, they were right. They did lose the strike. They lost the strike within 4 or 5 weeks. The growers did as they usually do during strikes. They raised the wages but refused to recognize the union. And the strike was over. 98% of the people had gone back to work. A few hundred people were so turned on by the activity that they joined the UFW staff. These were Mexican-American grape workers. Around the area of Delano, there was an enclave of Mexican-American grape workers. And even though the strike was defeated, the UFW said, no, no, the strike isn't over. It's still alive. And then through a series of sort of hit-and-miss trials, they came upon the strategy of a boycott. Now, today, if you think about a boycott, you know, if you have a losing struggle, if you're involved in a losing struggle, one of the first things you think of is a boycott. But that wasn't true back then. Back then, a boycott was kind of like a no-buy page on the back of a labor paper or something like that. Boycotts were not been popular. There had been the bus boycott, the bus boycott in the South, but that was a boycott that involved the people themselves not taking the bus. This was a boycott that was dependent upon supporters in the cities not buying grapes. And it was the reason that we choose boycotts now is largely because of the success of the UFW boycott, because after the UFW boycott, there was the Farah boycott, and then there was the International Nestle's boycott. They all were modeled on the UFW boycott, and what the unions now call corporate campaigns, all modeled on the UFW boycott. It was a genius thing to do at the time, which was then mimicked by other people.
One of the reasons the boycott was successful was that a lot of the growers were part of conglomerates that had other consumer products that were vulnerable, right?
Yes, although that's true. That's how they got the grape. That's how they got the wine grapes. That's how they got the wine. Was mostly because of the corporate nature of the growers who had other products that could be boycotted. But the table grapes, actually, the most effective part of the table grape boycott was boycotting table grapes. And the boycott started in 66 and it went to 1970, and it was probably the most successful boycott in American history. Millions of people stopped buying grapes. You can also think about the time, 1966 and 1970, the Southern Civil Rights Movement is over. It's been replaced by, black power and riots in the cities. There's a big split between liberals and radical students over the war in Vietnam. So there's liberals in the cities have really been cut off from any social movement. And this Chavez's appeal of there's this very easy thing you can do. It's a nonviolent thing. We're a nonviolent struggle. You can just not buy grapes, and if you don't buy grapes, you'll help us win. It was a very powerful appeal in those years when the cities were burning and people were dying and killing in Vietnam. It was a very powerful appeal, and Chavez himself was a very ecumenical figure. He was totally self-educated. He left school after the eighth grade. His curiosity had not been destroyed by school. He was a classic autodidact. He was tremendously interested in new things and different people. And so he was very interested in the boycott coalition, and he was a wonderful boycott organizer. And then he did this other thing that was kind of a genius thing, and that is that instead of, there have been other strikes that kind of gone to the cities for support. Very famously, people would go through New York City. People in the 20s would be on strike. They go through New York City to try to get support. But what the UFW did is instead of like going on a tour, they actually sent out farm workers to live in the boycott cities, to live in New York City, to live in Chicago, to live in Washington, and to organize the boycott there. And the appeal of the actual farm workers in these cities was tremendous and was crucial to winning the boycott. And again, looking back, it seems like, oh, kind of an obvious thing. But at the time, it was a new thing. And not only that, but think of the commitment of people to do it, because we know that they won. But they didn't know they were going to win. So for a farm worker who had, like, never moved out of the Central Valley and whose English was shaky, to go and take 3 or 4 years of their life and go live in a cold northern city at a time when there weren't Chicanos living all around the United States, a very isolated situation. They did it partially because they had a deep, deep belief in Cesar Chavez. It was at that period that Chavez really earned his spot in American history. A series of decisions and a determination and leadership to keep that boycott alive. And eventually, the growers had to sign, because of anything that's happening in the fields, but because they couldn't sell their product.
I'm speaking with Frank Bardicky, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, just out from Verso. Now, we're running low on time, and this is a large history, so let's move forward to the late 70s.
My book here.
Let's move forward to the late 70s when things started heading south. What happened?
Well, what happens is that the great contracts are lost in 1973. Now, you're going to have to read my book to, seeing as how we're short of time. I can't talk about why those contracts were lost, but it had a lot to do with the undemocratic structure of the union. The fact that farm workers could not get elected onto the union staff. And so, therefore, the policies in the grape fields between 1970 and 1973 did not reflect the interests of the farm workers, but rather reflected the interests of the union, which was now believed very thoroughly that the power of the union was not amongst farm workers, but was amongst their supporters. You can see how they would believe that because of the boycott, the victory of the boycott. So now you have Alinskyism, it's disdain for the rank and file. You have Catholic social action with its disdain for the flock. And you have this experience of winning a boycott. So in general, the rank and file does not matter inside the UFW. And you have this structure of the union. And, you know, they can mobilize the rank and file, and there are hundreds and thousands of farm workers who are grateful to the union, but the union isn't theirs. So what happens is when they lose the grape contracts, they then win a series of strikes and a series of elections in the vegetables. And the vegetables are not Mexican-American farm workers. They are all Mexican immigrants. Ex-braceros and sons of ex-braceros. And because of the structure of the work, which I talk a whole lot about in the book, because of the structure of work, the piece rate vegetable crews had a tremendous amount of power on the job. And when their power on the job was combined with the power of the union in the cities, this was an extremely strong force. And they won many contracts. They organized about a third of the vegetable industry in California, which is big. That's a lot. It's still not enough to guarantee a long-term victory, but it's a lot. Wages were very high. When I worked in the fields in the 1970s on a piece rate salary crew, we made about $14, $15 an hour, which is about $50 an hour now. And when I then left the fields and became a school teacher at the local adult school, I actually took a cut in wages. They had a lot of control over their work, but they only had a third of the industry. So there was a need to either grow or die, because the other two-thirds of the industry were not organized, could produce a head of lettuce at a much cheaper price than a UFW head of lettuce. And because a head of lettuce is like economists have a name for it. It's like it's a non-differentiated product. Is that right, Doug?
That would do, yeah. Just pure commodity.
Yeah. So you can't, you know, people aren't going to be able to choose a UFW head over a Teamster head. So the UFW, even though it was powerful, it was in danger. and because you couldn't exist for very long, one-third union and two-thirds non-union. So there was a debate between rank-and-file leaders and the union bureaucracy over expanding the union, or how much work to put into organizing the unorganized. And that debate became quite pointed. And Caesar begins to feel that the debate is really a cabal against him. And it's a much longer story than I'm telling you right here. But basically, the debate becomes a fight, and the bureaucracy wins it. Naturally, they always win those kinds of fights. And many of the local leaders in Salinas, the rank and file leaders, are kicked out of the union. I'm not talking about the staffers. I'm talking about the rank and file leaders of these crews are kicked out of the union. The union is tremendously weakened, and all of this happens in the few years before 1982. In 1982, Duke Majum becomes governor in California, ran on an anti-UFW platform, and severely weakens the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, which had been a victory of the UFWs. And there's a grower offensive, and the union is too weak to fight back.
Okay, and finally, what lessons, good and bad, are there for labor organizing today?
Well, there's no substitute for democracy. That's one thing. You know, I think that's the most important lesson. The Mike Parker book says, democracy is power. That's much more than a slogan. The main problem in the UFW was that that the power of their UFW allies was well represented inside the union, but rank and file power was not. And so ultimately, a union depends upon the support of the support of the workers. And if the workers don't really have a say in its policies, you're going to lose that support. So I think, and there were lots of, the question of locals, which is crucial, came up in UFW debates, at the very top on the executive board. And, luckily there's tapes of those debates. And you listen to those tapes, and they make all these arguments about why we can't have locals. It's kind of interesting. If we have locals, there's going to be all these divisions. We're not going to be able to form the unity that we need to mobilize farm workers and mobilize our supporters, because there's going to be all these parochial interests. If we have locals, the money, the dues are going to have to go through the locals, and we'll only get a part of it. The way it was in the UFW is the dues went straight to the center. If we have locals, the local leaders are going to be only interested in their own areas, and we're not going to be able to build a unified fighting force. And so is it like these are all kind of somewhat, not very, but somewhat persuasive anti-democratic arguments that are totally duplicated in the SEIU, where, the SEIU had locals of 50,000, 100,000 people in them. Where are they going to meet? In the Los Angeles Coliseum? You've got to, and that's what's happened to the SEIU. So you kind of, if you're going to build a strong union, it's got to be a democratic one, and a democratic union has got to have ways for workers to be elected to union office, and places that small numbers of workers can get together and influence decisions. Now, you can have that kind of democratic structure, and it can still not end in democracy. I'm not saying that's a guarantor of democracy, but it's an essential part of it, and the UFW didn't have it, and they paid for it.
I was Frank Bardicke, author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, just published by Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of I Heard It Through the Grapevine by the Slits. Till next week, bye.